16 to 1, a podcast about education, teaching, and learning. All right, ready? Let's go.
Oh, you got your podcast voice on.
Hi.
Hello.
Good evening.
Hello.
Welcome, friends, to another episode. Of 16 to 1.
I hate this episode already.
No, I love it. It's great. It's
How
be
are
good.
You?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Fine. I'll say fine.
Fine. Oh, I'm fine.
I feel fine.
That's not how the song goes. I feel fine. No.
It's as good as you're getting today.
It's as good as you get.
Is this the whole show?
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. Well,
doing fine.
Do you care to elaborate?
Not great.
Okay.
It was a long day.
Yeah.
We were without water, like, randomly.
Mm-hmm.
So that is a bit of a problem, as you can imagine.
Like running water and sewer, like that kind
of
water.
Oh, just like flush your toilet kind of water.
Yeah, the kind that is required to flush
toilets.
So then
it's just like, sorry, kids.
Imagine how stinky teenagers are on a normal day when there's running water and then... crank it up.
Yeah.
To 11.
And so then we were just like taking turns taking students to the porta potties outside.
That sounds like a fun adventure of a day.
Welcome to public school.
It's not in the job description.
So that's why I'm going to say I'm fine.
Okay.
How about you?
I'll give it to you. Well, I have running water most of the day, so.
Most.
Yeah. I mean, I was out and about.
Oh, okay.
I was taking the dog to get a haircut.
Yeah.
She looks real cute.
She does.
A candy corn bandana on.
Uh-huh.
The cat puked on the love sack this morning.
Okay.
At like 6:32, I sat bolt right in bed, upright in bed, mm-hmm. listening to the cat hork on the love sack.
Hork.
So that was fun.
Okay. We're just kind of going through it.
Yeah, but it's just been a time. It's been a time.
That should have been my answer. How are you? No, we went to the pumpkin patch. I love the pumpkin patch. It is like...
That was fun. That was a highlight.
It's just the best. Like, nothing makes me happier than picking out pumpkins.
I mean, and then we ate Taco Bell.
Like,
which
good
is like,
pumpkins, which I have to kind of steer you towards. Because you don't quite have the pumpkin eye yet.
I mean, I don't have the eye for...
You're getting there.
The eye for the orange, as it were.
Not just orange.
Well, yeah, you're right. I guess one of the ones we got was, like, grayish green.
Oh, I like that one. The sideways one.
It looks very strange, but I like it a lot. Yeah, he's weird looking.
But that was good, and it's, like, fun to support local. That makes me feel good.
Good.
Nice.
Good. I wonder how much...
We cannot record this late ever
how
again.
How many of the dog's mouth sounds do we just record for posterity?
Good.
Okay.
So what'd you pick this week?
Ooh, we're going to talk about how... Follow the money. We're going to talk about how public schools are funded.
Or not.
Or not. Hey, maybe. Hey, maybe. We should stop defunding education.
Let's just throw some pennies at this and hope it sticks.
Yeah. So a lot of this, we've touched on a lot of this here and there. And some of this about like sort of the breakdown of sources of funding, we actually just covered a few episodes ago in the Clear the List episode. But for the most part, public school districts again, we're talking about mostly in the U.S., but public school districts use a combination of state funds, local funds that usually come from things like property taxes, sometimes income taxes, and federal money. And I don't know if you remember this, but it at least blew my mind a little bit because the slice of the pie that comes from federal funding is very small. It's only 8%.
Yes.
And I just thought that was, I don't know why I think that's weird. I guess it's just, there's so much money floating around America. And I would have thought, I just would have
Where
thought
is it?
That, well, maybe it's an offshore banking
account
somewhere.
Is this one of
those
things that happens because of global warming?
The money evaporates?
The money evaporates into the ozone.
And dries up.
With my mom's, with her hairspray she's been using since the 80s.
Yeah, stuff is very flammable, yeah.
You know, we talk about money like there is so much of it, and it's just like, where is it?
I just feel
And then, okay, so the day that Facebook went down, do you remember that fateful day?
I do remember that, yes.
What a great day that was. That was one of my
best
days.
You know, really, would it be the worst thing if it just didn't come back ever?
No, I just miss Instagram. I'm still on Team Instagram, but yes.
Yeah, you do like your Insta.
I know. I wish they weren't associated. That was... Anyways, we'll get into that.
Yeah. Well, they might be forced to break them up again. That'd be nice.
Well, I hope to own it someday, so that's great for me. Good.
So, CEO My life of Instagram, goal. Your next.
Hello, Instagram.
Owner and CEO of Instagram.
Your next owner. Where was I going?
The day that Facebook was down. Mm-hmm. You were thinking about money or...
Oh, okay. Yeah. Thank you. Great work. Mm-hmm. Can't record this late. So that day, everyone was talking about how Zuckerberg lost like tons of money. Like I think someone on Twitter, take it for what you will, said he lost like $2 billion. And everyone on Twitter was like, see, money's fake. Like we have no concept of what it is.
I think there was one tweet that I saw. It was like $70,000 a second.
Yeah.
Or something insane like
that. But that kind of confirmed in my head that money is made up.
Yes, money because, like, is where not is real.
It? Like, where did it go? Now, whose money is it?
It's kind of fake. It kind of doesn't matter.
Is it just because the stock dropped so much?
No.
Or was Facebook actually pooping money?
Well, yes. Yes.
Because they locked themselves out of their own business.
They sure did. They.
You know what? For that, they should lose some money.
I agree.
We say as we pay Facebook to promote our ads.
So Facebook mostly... I don't think it was a stock price drop that people were saying was causing. It was, I'm pretty sure it was the loss of ad revenue because Facebook just makes all of its money by serving up little things for people to buy.
Like us.
And when it can't do that for like 6 hours because they lock their own engineers out of the buildings.
God, just a beautiful world. Yeah. Okay. Well, anyways.
Yeah, anyway.
Along with what you're talking about, the federal
budget
here. Uh-huh. I'm just like, is money real? Like what?
No, I don't think
money is real. Where do we draw the line?
Personally, I do not think money is real. I mean, that sounds very silly because money does have real, tangible impacts on
and it physically exists.
On our lives. And yes, sometimes it does physically exist. Sometimes it doesn't. Does your bank account, the dollars in your bank account, do those physically exist? Who knows? Who knows?
You know, I thought for a long time that somewhere my money really sat.
Oh, just like a pile of dollar bills.
I thought I had like my own box or something.
Your own box of dollars. That's when you get a bank account. You rent a physical space that has dollars in it.
I know when I was younger, I was definitely like, yeah, let's just go get my money out. And it was just my money that was being kept in this very secure area. It never occurred to me that it just like got shoved in with everybody else's money. And my money is just a number on paper.
That's cute. I'm going to think about my bank account that way from now on.
It makes Chase a lot more approachable.
Yeah.
It gives them a friendly face.
Yeah.
It makes me feel like
they're
they
just
care.
Like holding on to your dollars. It makes you feel what?
It makes me feel like they care.
Oh, they care. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, and as soon as I got a job teaching, I knew that couldn't be true because there's not enough money for them to care about what I got.
I thought you all cared. I thought
you
cared.
And then they spit out my ATM receipt and they cough on it. And
yeah,
that's the only proof that I have money.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Not sure how much of that's going to be kept, but...
Oh, we're keeping it
all.
We
went through it.
We're just keeping it all.
Carry on.
Okay, so anyway, back to this breakdown. So we did talk about it, but so the breakdown's about 48% of a public school budget come from state resources, and that includes, you know, income, sales tax, and fees, and other stuff. And then 44% is contributed locally, primarily through property taxes of homeowners in the area. Yeah. That last 8%, that's the federal part. Which
it's like,
it really does blow my mind. I don't know why.
To get credit.
I don't know why I don't know why I expected better.
Why?
Of America, but I did, I think. So, of that 8%, a big part of it, it's distributed directly to local schools.
You said the big part of the 8%.
A big part. A large majority.
92% of that 8%.
Of that tiny
goes to
amount.
Title I.
It really does. It's a lot of it's distributed directly to schools. And then, so the federal government does not have authority to set unfunded mandates for local schools, which means schools and districts can always refuse federal money.
Mm-hmm.
It basically is like, if there are strings attached to this money, they can
and they
choose
don't
not
do the
to
strings,
accept it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that's possible, but I mean, oftentimes they will take the money that they can get, but they don't have to. But the programs that get funded by those federal dollars include, like you just mentioned, Title I, that's geared towards students from low-income families, provides money to local districts to improve academic performance of those students, English language acquisition, Reading First, which is, I think it's kind of like a Head Start reading mm-hmm. kind of type thing, Individuals with Disabilities and Education Act, which is, we mentioned that in our assistive technology mm-hmm. episode just recently.
I mean, that's where the money should be going. In my head, like, mm-hmm. You know.
Well, we talked about how some of those technologies can be pricey. So
this in is my head, of, I'm like, good, check. Yeah, mm-hmm. Let's maybe throw like 10% next time.
Let's bump it up 2%. It's okay.
And you then, know how long that would take Congress to approve? My teaching career would be over.
Yeah. And then the last bit goes to improving teacher quality, grants to improve teacher quality. So, you know, training, professional development, stuff like that.
I like that.
Yeah.
That's good. That's less expensive. It's really expensive.
It'd be
nice. It's expensive to be a teacher. Like, to keep your license, it's expensive.
If you could imagine if they just spent 9% instead of 8%. I mean, well, again, that's just like the slice of the pie. So what we really need is for the whole pie to get bigger. So we don't just want to increase the federal government's percent. We want to actually just increase the whole thing. But anyway.
We just want to increase the payout, basically, to actual.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So why don't you talk a little bit about... As we zero mm-hmm. in on Ohio because it's very familiar to us.
Yeah.
And there's, so you have some notes here about the way that it has worked and how to funding ties to school performance and other things like that. And then I also have some kind of very recent updates just to add on to the end of that. But I wanted to throw these notes in here about how it works in Ohio because it is reflective of the way national conversations around school funding are going. So the thing, we'll talk about it, but it's House Bill 110 that was just recently passed. The changes that are made by that, those are the kinds of changes that school districts across the country are trying to confront and deal with and figure out how to legislate in their own way. So without further ado, why don't you jump in?
So this is about public schools, obviously. So that's like the only focus we really have here. But basically, public school districts in Ohio are financed with a combination of federal, state, and local funds, like we just talked about. At the state level, school districts receive funding from ODE, which is our Overlord Department of Education.
Yes. That's what the acronym stands for.
Yes, the Overlord. And then also, that's like their general revenue funds. And then the Ohio Lottery profits pays into the education system.
Ah, yes.
Which we can't forget. It's very important.
Yeah.
Which, you know, maybe I should buy more lottery tickets.
I'm not sure that's a good
investment. Let me buy my way out of this.
Not sure.
I'm giving back.
You're just making that pie bigger.
Okay, so at the local level,
though. And you have a chance to get rich. Okay.
Oh, when you say it like that. At the local level, though, school districts receive funding from locally levied property taxes. And then school districts can also receive funding from income taxes approved by voters. And these levies that occur, I'm speaking about my experience growing up where I grew up and also working in the district that I work at. These levies are very, very hard to pass. I don't know if it's just our area of Ohio that is this way, but it is always an uphill battle to pass levies, is what I will say. Most levies are very hard to pass.
I don't actually, we probably should have looked up something about that, but I was going to say, I remember it. So the district where you teach, mm-hmm. that's where I went to school growing up. But I remember growing up that it was easier to pass levies. And I think that it's really interesting.
I think it comes and goes.
Yeah, well, I think it has a lot to do with the content of the levy and what is being
the
funded.
The politics at play.
There's mm-hmm. There are a lot of politics involved in these local, like local politics can get dirty and nasty and weird quickly.
The district that I grew up in, we failed a big levy so many times that when I was in middle school, we had pay to play for athletics and everything.
Mm-hmm.
By the time I was in high school, we had recuperated it. So we were no longer still pay to play. But even still, that school district is unable to pass levies.
Yes.
So they basically were able, I think it was an operating levy that they finally passed, but I could be wrong about that. But mm-hmm. They did get it passed.
Well, that's,
they got kind of the funding. And then now the levy that they're trying to pass is for the building of a new school, and it has failed.
So those are the ones, that's 60, what I was 40. About to say. I think that those ones that I remember from when I was younger, those were, I'm pretty sure, just pretty standard operating levies. And those are much easier. It's just like, hey, if you want your kids to have a good education.
Hey, you like your teachers?
Go ahead and pass the levy so your teachers can get paid. But these other ones that become more difficult, like you just mentioned, often have new construction attached mm-hmm. to them or new land acquisition or big ticket items tearing down a school and building a new one. Those are things that are much more difficult to convince people that they should foot the bill for. So mm-hmm.
It's very difficult.
It does make
sense.
Especially
areas, sorry, not to keep going but
okay.
Where you grew up and where I grew up, and it's a very rural area.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
that makes the land issues even more complicated.
Yes.
Is that we're talking about families who own large portions of acreage.
Yes, it could have levies can have an outsized impact on certain members of certain communities, and when like you're saying, especially rural communities, mm-hmm. where you get single landowners who have masses of land, mm-hmm. you can imagine property taxes very impact difficult. Them very much differently.
Yeah,
from how it might impact you, or
especially
me.
When we know that, like, generally speaking, farmers are operating at a loss. Most of them are, I should say, not all of them, but it is harder and harder, right, to make your living as just a farmer. So
yeah,
that especially I see at play a lot. So yep. Anyways, the amount of state funds that a district receives is just based on this formula, and the formula takes into account the student enrollment and the property wealth of the district.
Yeah.
So
this is the one, by the way, so the formula that you're talking about here that we used to use, this is one that's been held to be unconstitutional several times through mm-hmm. Ohio. I mean, I don't know if it's the formula itself or the way that it's carried out, but whatever it is, we've been found as a state. We've been sued several times in the last couple decades about our funding distribution
and dare we?
The fact that it doesn't equitably serve students. We actually have, it's kind of similar to that case, I think in Oregon it was mm-hmm. that we talked about that one episode where it was just like, is this a fair way to serve students? And the answer also in Ohio has been no. So anyway,
so
pick it back up.
So all of these funds, along with the profits from the lottery, go to fund Ohio's 612 public school districts, the 49 joint vocational school districts, the 319 public community schools, and then 7 STEM schools on top of that. So not only are they funding all of that, but they're also taking care of the Ohio Department of Education, and that includes the funding for early childhood ed, the preschool special education assessments, and the report card that we refuse to kill.
State report card that
let's
supposedly
keep funding that.
It's
a great indicator of a school.
Yeah. It's a letter grade for your school district's supposed performance in terms of the academic achievement
so
of
annoying.
Students. Yeah.
Okay. Well. House Bill 110. Take it away, Chelsea.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So this was amending the formula that you were just talking about. But there's a new funding model now for public schools in Ohio. And it was a pretty big issue around the time of reconciling the budget. So the state budget for this year is when everybody came together and kind of hashed this all out. But basically, there's been a push for quite a while in Ohio to find a new school funding formula. And they agreed to implement what is called the Cutt-Patterson model for the next biennium, so in the next two-year budget cycle. This model, apparently, I'm not super familiar with it, but it sounds kind of interesting. It creates a base cost model that relies primarily on statewide employee compensation data and fixed staff to student ratios. These calculations in turn determine the district charter and STEM schools' base per pupil amounts, which drive the bulk of their state funding. Relative to the current base amount of $6,020 per student, the average base under the new formula, if fully implemented, rises to about $7,200 per student. The higher base amount explains the new formula's overall price tag of about $2 billion in additional state spending. So they're going to phase in this increase over a couple of years. And they also have done this thing where they're like, well, if you get tired of phasing in the increase, you don't have to keep phasing it in. So I'm not exactly sure how or why this legislation is really even binding, because you could just modify the formula whenever you feel like it. Mm-hmm. Like, they've built it into the law that they can just change their minds later if they want to, which is very interesting. I suppose you probably need to do that in case some catastrophic economic event, you know, if there's another pandemic or something.
Oh,
and there's
a big
budget shortfall. But, you know, who knows? I just thought that was an interesting point.
Yeah,
there's included in this new formula is an equalizing mechanism that adjusts each district's base amount to account for its property wealth and resident income, akin to the current funding formula. This is done to ensure that higher poverty districts receive more state aid than those that can raise more through local taxes. So there's always been this imbalance because of what we were just talking about, those levies and the amount of the very high percentage of funding for school districts that comes from local sources. If you can wrap your head around the issues here, a lot of them come from the fact that wealthy districts can raise a lot more money in mm-hmm. those kinds of levy situations than, you know, higher poverty areas.
Well, yeah, and because their houses are worth more.
Yeah, property taxes.
Taxes that do come in are a lot higher.
Yep, when we're talking about having a slice of property taxes being dedicated to school funding, if you have way higher value homes. You can see where this is going. So part of this new model is to try to address some of the imbalances that come from that kind of funding model. The new model retains various categorical funding streams that provide districts with extra aid based on pupil characteristics, like being an English language learner or a student with a disability, but it does eliminate a few smaller components, and those are like performance bonuses and K-3 literacy funding, likely in an effort to shift some money to pay for an increased base. So basically, we're just moving some things around from special programs and trying to make a more attractive and equitable model for everyone. Mm-hmm. It directly funds public charter and STEM schools, private schools, scholarships, and inter-district open enrollment students rather than through deductions from those district state funding, which I thought was pretty interesting. It's supposed to alleviate political tensions that come with funding.
I welcome that.
These alternative paths, you know, eliminate distortions in the formula when choice students were included in their home district's student counts. So like open enrolled students get counted in terms, you know, they technically live in their home districts. And then where does the funding go? Because they live there and property taxes determine money, but they don't really go there. So
yeah, that's a that's one we deal with a lot because our open enrolled numbers are very high.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I would say that there are some criticisms of this new funding model for sure. I don't want to get too much more in the weeds about this, but it does attempt to address some of what has historically been an unconstitutional and pretty unfair funding model for students in Ohio. So you also had some notes in here about Colorado, which is another, they're kind of like a test kitchen for educational policy in Colorado. I don't know why that is, but they're historically kind of, I don't know. I just remember in grad school reading a lot about cases in Colorado and Tennessee, some states I don't know.
A lot of Texas stuff for some
Texas
reason.
Well, it's just so big. I mean, it's hard not to pay attention to what's going on there, but why don't you tell us what's going on in what Colorado is trying to do.
So each state, just like Ohio, obviously has its own formula for how they fund schools. And so like we mentioned, in most states, local property tax is a majority of that funding. So Great Education Colorado reports on its website that due to the falling property tax revenues in Colorado in recent years, they've had to make up some of that difference through additional state funding. But because the recession has led to smaller state budgets as well, it's left school districts, right, in Colorado without enough money basically to go around. Mm-hmm. Like there isn't enough to support it. Mm-hmm. And so basically what's happening is that states like Colorado are taking advantage of the economic uptick to like build back what they need to be putting out into schools basically because they've been losing it. But it's a really, really slow process. Mm-hmm. So since schools have to provide the basics like heat, electricity, and transportation, even though they've been dealing with all of these budget cuts, that means like in most schools, we see it happen in the classroom. And so for like the Coloradan teachers, they're having fewer programs for students, larger class sizes, and a whole bunch of other problems that come from this funding. Interesting. And I think it's really interesting because when you think about Colorado is like one of the states that everybody moves to, it feels like. So I would like to read more about how exactly this funding works because
I'm curious to hear you say that they, you have found that their property values are decreasing there.
I know. And that's why I was shocked as well. So I will do some more research on that. But basically the long and short of it is that other states are facing the exact same problems that we are. Mm-hmm. And then it's not unique. You and I mean,
I would like definitely say that part of Ohio's change is definitely the timing of it. I think so, corresponding with what people are saying is it, like you're just talking about a temporary uptick in the economy. Yeah. They're like, oh, we got to recover all these funds. Mm-hmm. School districts everywhere are scrambling.
If you think about it, I mean, it also does sort of make sense because Colorado's an expensive state. Mm-hmm. Everything there is expensive. Land is expensive.
Land is expensive. Things are expensive.
Buying things in Colorado is expensive.
Breathing.
When you get there, it's expensive. No. But you know what I mean, though? Like, Ohio isn't the top of the charts, especially in the area that we live, as far as like price, right? Per acreage.
Property values.
We're not. And I can think of communities in Ohio that are probably close to some of the Denver suburbs, but generally speaking are up, like the highs and lows are much different here, I guess. Do you know what I'm trying to say?
Well, I think
I feel like the cost of living there is just so much more.
Yes, the cost of living is much higher.
So the homes that I live in would be twice as. So it's just it's an interesting problem.
It's not probably not true across the whole state. But my sister lives outside of Denver, and it's like it's kind of funny because my parents would sort of groan and roll their eyes because she was living outside of Denver, and I was living outside of Annapolis, Maryland, and those are two of the most expensive places, cost of living wise, in the country to live.
Yeah, good job, both.
We live in these places where the school districts are pretty well funded and taken care of.
Yeah.
But like you're saying, it's just. Especially in school districts, budgets are always incredibly, incredibly tight. And so if there is a temporary blip in the economy due to something like a pandemic or a housing crisis or whatever it is, those temporary blips, those can affect public schools much more acutely than other sectors of the economy.
Yeah. And I'm thinking like Boulder, right? Like one of the, just some of these communities are just astonishing, but. It also makes you wonder if, like, maybe that budget wasn't as friendly as it should have been to begin with. Like, I think that's what we're seeing, right? And not like, you know, you and I have had a lot of conversations, like, how do you prepare the economy for another COVID pandemic? And, like, it's been, like, a very, I don't know, like, I feel like following that conversation has been very difficult because it's, like, you're faced with mom and pop places closing. Because they weren't planning for something like this.
Yeah.
So at the same time, are we doing that to our schools? Are we not expecting? You know what I mean? Like, that's where I am.
I think that Colorado is in an earlier stage of doing the same reconciliation that Ohio just tried to do. Now, whether or not it's going to work, I think everywhere across the country, the problems are being magnified by the economic effects of the pandemic. Yeah. But I think that everywhere, because of the percentage of funding that comes from local sources, everywhere in this country, public school-wise, is going to have to go through the same reckoning in terms of how do we provide equitable educations to students when our funding comes from local sources and those local sources have wildly different absolute amounts of money to contribute, right?
Yeah, those were just some of my thoughts as I was reading about Colorado mostly. So not just a Ohio problem for sure. It seems to be a national problem. I guess I can't say that certainly, but generally speaking, it reads that way. So
no, for sure it is. Yeah.
So a little bit about the options for school levies. Is that okay? So as we mentioned, property tax is the big one, right? For the collection of taxes charged on the value of the property. And then each district must follow a process described in Ohio law in order for those taxes to be levied on the property within the district. Is this how it is used everywhere? This unit of value? Mills. Is this common?
Yeah, mills.
So this is like a...
When you go to the ballot box next month...
It's like probably, so many mills of things.
You'll see if there are levies in place. And this is not just for school funding, obviously, but if there's any levy...
Yeah, it's like because, our fire department.
Right, right. So levy for like emergency services or levy for the operating budget for a town hall or whatever it is, you will often see... Yeah, because I remember having a conversation with my parents about this. One of the first times I voted, there was a local measure, a levy, and I was just like,
What's a mill?
What's a mill?
Yeah, it's not very well explained.
Well, no, I mean...
Like, it's just 0.1 cents.
It's one of those things that they should tell you in high school that this is just, you know, a thing that you're going to need to know as an adult. But anyway, yeah, 0.1% or 0.1 cent
of a cent
in cash.
And then the millage is the factor that's just applied to the assessed value. Basically, to produce that tax revenue. So they look at your home, all of these things, this magic math that occurs, and then they tax us.
Yeah. They're trying to the school. You're trying to figure out how many mills the levy has.
So anytime we're like sent a flyer, it's like, it'll be about this much for this much of a house or whatever. So they give you
they try to put this language in easier
to
understand.
Like, each day it's like a penny or whatever. And it's
like, if you just stop buying a cup of coffee one time a month or whatever, that's how much.
That's how they sell it to
you. But they don't say it like that on the ballot. They say it. They do it in terms of millage and mills.
So then when you get to the ballot and you're like, well, I think I want to support this, but that sounds like a lot of money.
Right.
Can I afford this?
Yeah, that's the other thing is that
that's language, what that language does to me. That's what I think is the bad press of it.
There's a bit of a voter informing voters and having informed, you know, voting, informed citizenry going on here that I think probably we should either make sure that we teach people what that means or update the language that we use on ballot initiatives, because it's not clear and people get confused and they're like, wait, that either sounds like a really tiny amount of money or a really huge amount of money.
Yeah, I can't tell. It's either or. It is either nothing or it is everything. And that's fine.
Yeah.
We included the school levies at the end of this because this is where schools end up when the funding that's being provided to them isn't enough. So like the district that Chelsea grew up in, the one that I work in, the one that I grew up in, like we are every so many years going back through the cycle of it's time for an operating levy or whatever. So there are operating expenses, there are general ongoing improvements, there are recreational purposes, specific permanent improvements, or classes of improvements. And these are all reasons for levies, basically. So what this means is that you could build community centers, cultural centers, school safety and security things, purchase of educational technology, the debt service for bonds issued for school construction. So like a couple of the communities that we're familiar with around here, that's what they're going through, is trying to build new schools and not being able to get that passed at the millage that basically for the amount that they want. And so the one specific school district that I'm thinking of, they've gone a few times back to the ballot at different millages, basically saying, okay, we don't need to do all of these projects, we just need to focus on this.
Yeah, it's obviously easier to pass on a tax burden to people living in a district when you ease that tax burden somewhat.
So a lot of times you might see a school reappear if you're voting, and it might be for, hopefully, for, they normally go at least for a smaller amount, and it's because maybe they have changed the plan for the school or have changed other plans they were going to use for it. But I would say normally if you're voting on a levy for a school, it's usually operating or new construction.
Yeah.
Like, generally speaking, those are the two most common that I've seen, at least.
I guess the one thing that just a passing thought about school levies, I used to be of the mindset of just vote yes on every single school levy, because I would have said at that time, like, we just have to fund education and we have to do a better job of funding education.
Yeah.
But since that time, I've realized that the people who are in charge of putting together the levies and the legislation and the proposals for funding and spending in districts are not always the people who I would trust to have the best interests of students at heart. So unfortunately, there's now a kind of tension where I'm like, I really want to support this school district. I want to do what's best for these kids, but I don't think this levy is doing
it. And I think that that's what a lot of schools face, regardless of thinking of the school that I grew up in. That's exactly how it was, trying to pass levies for us. Like, we got a new high school built when I was young and then couldn't get, you know, they made to do pay to play for sports and for band and stuff like that in high school. So there's like, there's
you also have, I was going to add, you have a couple more months. People have to do class fundraisers for like, to put on proms or like to host graduations to, you know.
Yeah. Like, these are all the things that aren't
to go to PD
covered.
Yeah.
So like, levies are great to help support these things. But even still, even by passing or not passing a levy, there are still things that fall on teachers and students to try to make ends meet
for sure
for these like normal experiences. But yeah, I mean, gosh, levies are just so, it's so slippery.
I mean, I really just want to, I suppose I'm issuing a challenge to superintendents everywhere, but if you're in charge of a school district and you're a superintendent and you feel like you don't have support for a levy, it could be the case that your voters are all just deranged and they don't see the beauty of your plan, but it's probably something more along the lines of people do want to support their kids' learning environments and they want to support their teachers and they want to do all of that, but they don't agree with you that the way you're attempting to spend money is the way to best educate kids.
Well, and also a lot of times, I mean, the school that I grew up in is currently unable to pass this levy to build the new school that they need. And one of the issues that the community is dealing with is that there was a focus to build an athletic field that didn't seem to be a top priority. And now they want to put out a levy to increase the taxes. You know what I mean? And so these are the types of things that make it very hard for schools to pass levies. And
so they built something that the district generally doesn't approve of too much in retrospect.
The community generally does not support it. But now what building this one thing has done has created a big divide. And now because of, even though this thing is probably paid off by now, people are still like, well, you built that thing.
So you built this thing that I didn't want to have built. Now I'm never going to trust you with my money.
Or it didn't seem necessary, or it was fine. Like, there's, you insert whatever thing you would like to support it with, but that's what a lot of schools are dealing with, right? And so then you have leadership changes. You might have a rollover of an entire new administration. They're fighting the battles that the people who've retired since have, you know what I mean? So it's it's very, very sticky.
The local politics of it are horrible. Yeah, the local politics of these things get really messy.
So what this leaves for school, pretty much everything, right? So we have to raise money for extracurriculars, especially for music groups. I was a softball coach for a while, and we had to do some things to try to make sure we could cover. Now, there are, like, athletic boosters in the event, in, like, the case of my school, but it's still not enough to cover every single thing that we need.
Boosters, by the way, is if you don't have a kid in school, or if you don't remember, or if you weren't participating in groups in high school, booster groups are usually parent volunteer groups organized around raising money for
supporting
these programs.
And then, like, I'm in charge of the senior class at the high school I teach at, so we help orchestrate graduation and the gift and all of those things. So we usually have to do a fundraiser to try to make some money for the gift. Or junior prom requires fundraising.
It's a gift that outgoing seniors leave to their
school.
To the school, yeah.
And that's why, referencing back to a previous episode, that's why things like Donors Choose and Amazon List for classrooms exist. Because we do not have the funding.
Right now I'm working with
a couple of the new young teachers at my school about writing basically kind of a baby grant within our district to try to get some new books. Like, but we have to search for these things, and you and I mean, like, we have to learn how to write, not like true grants, but you and I mean,
teachers,
like,
teachers have to wear many hats, and one of them is knowing how to write grant applications. Can you imagine?
And then also just raising money to attend professional development. I've seen that happen a lot, especially when, like, at my district, we don't get any allocated funds to do that. So you will see from time to time that there's a group of teachers who want to do this one specific type of training, and they'll try to fundraise for that. Yeah. So what does that mean? Stop defunding education.
Maybe
we should stop defunding.
We should stop defunding education.
Might as well try.
Maybe.
But also, that compels me to say, find ways to support locally when you can.
Yeah.
And also, if you are the person who is listening to this saying, I have some concerns with the district that I live in that is preventing me from voting yes for them, I would urge you to get to the bottom of that.
Write a letter.
Just do something. Like,
organize
being mad at a district and kids that probably aren't really the kids you're mad at, or whoever it is you're mad at, you know. But also on the other side, for people who do own all of these things that get taxed, I get it too, you know? So maybe the federal government just coughs up 9%.
Maybe
8.5.
Add a few more dollars on there.
Whew, I got worked up about spend. This one.
Yeah, you're a little worried.
Do you want to do last episode's question?
I would love to.
Because I really want to do this episode's question, because I might squeal.
You're very excited about this one. This one has pictures that we're going to have to put on the website.
Yeah, I'm going to have to find some that I'm allowed to.
Yeah, you're going to have to post those on.
Oh, they're so cute. Okay, go ahead.
Okay, so last episode's fill in the blank. Anne Sullivan, known most famously as being Helen Keller's teacher, is a notable alumna of this school located in Watertown, Massachusetts. The school was originally called New England Asylum for the Blind. What is this famous school for the blind's name now? And that's Perkins School for the Blind.
Yeah, they Perkins. Still exist.
Yeah.
Still in operation.
Yeah.
Okay, is it my turn?
This is the oldest school for the blind in the country, right?
Yeah.
Didn't you say that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It changed its name, but yes.
Yep. All right, this episode's fill in the blank.
Oh, I'm so excited. Okay, so are you ready?
I'm ready.
A famous bear was seen over the weekend. So let's just call it, for listeners of the future, early-ish October 2021. Okay. So this famous bear was seen over the weekend in Grand Teton National Park with her four bear cubs.
Aww.
This famous bear was born in 1996 and is far outliving the normal age of a grizzly, coming in at 25 years young this year.
Aww.
She weighs over 400 pounds.
Okay.
And when she stands on her hind legs, is more than 7 feet tall. She has raised more than 16 cubs and grand cubs, but has lost half of them to human errors, like getting hit by cars.
Aww.
She has been seen by visitors to Grand Teton teaching her cubs how to hunt, how to look both ways when crossing the street, and how to avoid human interactions, even though historically she has lived very close to the roads because she's trying to avoid the male grizzlies.
Oh, interesting.
She has attempted to attack two different humans for getting too close to her young.
Don't touch my
babies. But she never killed them, so she escaped euthanasia.
Oh.
Which,
good for her,
also contributes to her unusually old age. Mm-hmm. Because by the time they live this long, they've usually attempted to kill somebody or have killed somebody. So,
yeah, particularly in high volume parks, like yes, national parks. Like
so
this.
I also want to mention grizzlies are protected, so don't get mad. Okay. You can't make her a rug. But the question is, now that I've given this grizzly bear the most fascinating bio of her life.
Yeah.
What is her name? Mm-hmm. Who is that bear, basically? Mm-hmm. She has a name. She has a Facebook page. She has a whole following.
Wow.
And I will, if I can get any of these pictures that I'm allowed to use, I will include one eventually because she is a staple of the Grand Tetons. And especially
because...
Well,
at least link to whoever took these photos or
yeah,
whatever.
She has, she's been seen for, I mean, all of these years, usually, rarely with one, usually with two or three. And then
cubs,
yes.
Aww.
And this, I think it was last year, she had four. And somebody had actually said that they had killed her, and they were like gloating about it. And like the greater Grand Teton area got like super ticked, and because they like she's like their pet basically of the Grand Tetons, and so they were searching and searching for her, and they were very concerned that she had, but she came out of hibernation late.
Oh,
she was just taking her time,
taking an extra long nap.
If you got four cubs, you're gonna need it.
Yeah.
So my long story short, who is that famous grizzly from Grand Teton?
That's pretty cute.
Oh my gosh, they're so fuzzy.
Yeah, don't pet them, though.
Yeah, we didn't get to see any bears there.
Not this time.
It was too hot.
We saw bears in Yellowstone previous
not
summer.
Grizzlies.
No.
I thought they were black bears.
Yeah, I think you're right. They were black bears.
We didn't see any of these guys. These
not
things
the
are
grizzlies.
400 pounds and 7 feet tall.
Yeah, that's a large bear.
Ain't no way I'm going near her. Okay. Do you want to do what you learned?
Oh, yeah. I'd love
we
to.
Still got one more segment.
One more segment.
And then I'm going to go bake cookies.
Okay. That's... sounds delicious. I can't wait for that. Okay, what I learned. Yes, I've been getting so crafty recently.
Yeah, you really have.
I've been doing a lot of crafts because I've been trying to get ready for a couple of different Halloween-related costuming things. Yeah, so what I learned this week was how to work with this thing, this stuff called Warbla, which is basically heat-moldable crafting plastic. Mm-hmm. It comes in this big roll, and it just kind of feels like a big roll of, like, I don't know, it's just like flat plastic basically, but it comes all rolled up, and you get a heat gun and you just sort of pass the heat gun over it a bit, and it gets really kind of, it's kind of like sticky and pliable, and then you mold it into whatever shape you want and then pray that it stays where you tried to put
yes.
it. And at the end, it will re-harden into whatever shape you've made.
I need to see this happen in real time.
Yeah,
I'm very interested.
It's interesting. It's really expensive stuff. So that's primarily the reason that I have not played with it before now, because it's a super expensive
really?
Hobby. But people who do, you know, big time, like... cosplay type stuff, like people who make that kind of stuff for a living, they will use Warbla, and I've watched people craft with it in videos and tutorials and stuff, and I've always been interested to try it.
Pro
and what
so what part was that, the face shield?
Yeah, I was making Kate for her costume. It requires this helmet that has a face shield, and I got her a motorcycle helmet that's all, you know, the right like shape sort of, but it doesn't have the face shield that this helmet is supposed to have, so I made a face shield out of Warbla.
So cool.
And I painted it, and it was a lot of fun. I did some sewing. I did some clay bake, like moldable polymer clay baking, because I'm making Kate a dice box for our D&D campaigns. And that's, I'm making it like the book from Hocus Pocus. So there's a lot of Halloween-y, crafty, spooky
yeah,
season and stuff going on. So that's what I learned. I learned how to use Warbla.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah. How about you?
I was listening to My Favorite Murder, which is my favorite podcast aside from obviously ours. And they did an episode.
Obviously ours.
Obviously. They did an episode, pretty sure it was Georgia, was talking about this guy, William Moulton Marston. Are you familiar with him?
No.
Okay.
I don't think so.
So he's a famous psychologist, and he actually created Wonder Woman.
Oh.
And her Lasso of Truth.
A psychologist. So not a comic
He's
book
He's a
writer.
Psychologist.
Or is he also a
so,
comic book
So, wait.
Oh, my bad.
Guess what William Moulton Marston is most well known for creating?
I don't
know. Say Wonder Woman and her Lasso of Truth.
Okay.
That would be the obvious answer.
Then I will have no answer. Because...
Okay. He is most well known for creating the systolic blood pressure test. Oh. Do you know what that led to?
The lie detector?
The polygraph. Yes. Yeah. So his wife, Elizabeth Holloway Marston, was an attorney and a psychologist. And the two of them worked together on creating basically what would become eventually the polygraph test, which is a bit of a nightmare.
That's the lasso of truth.
That's the lasso of truth. So his wife, Elizabeth Holloway Marston, was part of the inspiration for Wonder Woman, as well as their other partner, Olive Byrne.
Okay.
And so he gave Wonder Woman the lasso of truth as a way to reflect on the emotions that play, like the emotions that work their way up as we're telling the truth. So it's kind of cool to think about, though, right? Because his whole thing was, well, their whole thing, I shouldn't say his, the work that they did, right, was to create the polygraph essentially as a way to decide what kind of reactions our body has to lying or to truth.
Wow.
And so I know the polygraph isn't great work. Like, I understand that.
Yeah, it's not admissible as evidence.
Yeah.
But it is
interesting work to think about because I cannot stand lying. It makes me feel icky. So
you probably wouldn't pass a polygraph if you were lying.
Miserably. I would not even. They'd be like, what's your name? And I'd be like, Chelsea.
I mean, you probably failed just trying to tell the truth.
That's what I mean. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So those two, I mean, he was mostly the one who created Wonder Woman, but she's based off of his wife and their partner, Olive. And the lasso of truth is a little nod to the work that they did, but also just to, I mean, what's more powerful than Wonder Woman when she can literally hug you with her lasso and you just spill it? Like,
yeah,
that's a power that not a lot of them have.
Interesting.
So isn't that cool?
Huh.
I was like, as I was driving, I was like, I'm sorry. Did they just say? So then I had to go back and replay like 10 minutes of it because I was like, is this still the guy?
Where did we? Yeah. How did we get here?
I was so confused because I was like, polygraph, Wonder Woman.
Wait a minute.
Yeah. So that's what I learned. Interesting. So
the lasso of truth, a psychologist is and attorney based on the polygraph. The lasso of truth is kind of based on interesting.
That
I would not have known that.
It's kind of cool.
It is kind of cool.
Makes Wonder Woman way cooler. She's already top notch, but. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of cool to learn. Because like I said, I was like, am I hearing this?
Huh.
That's a good one.
The more you know.
The more you know.
The more you know. All right. Anything else? Wrap up thoughts?
Our next episode, we will be including when we will not be releasing episodes.
Yes.
Because holidays are coming. I believe Thanksgiving is supposed to be a release and it will not be. And then we will also be taking off. We will confirm dates, but usually the week of Christmas.
Yeah.
If that is an episode week.
Just because it's a little wild that time of year. We did this last year too. We're going to be taking off 1 week for Thanksgiving, 1 week for Christmas. But we'll tell you when.
Yeah, I was just mostly warning that that time is coming. So I think we have, maybe two more episodes before Thanksgiving?
Something like that.
And then, that's it.
Yep.
So we'll update. I think that's all I have.
Time to go bake cookies?
I think I'm ready for cookies.
Okay. Yeah. Let's go make some cookies.
This was a fun one, I think.
Yeah.
I'm curious to see what you keep.
Oh, I'm keeping all of it. Okay, single thing. I'm not going to edit a word out of this.
Well, great.
You should probably make some weird noises now to play us out.
Good job.
It's over.
Bye.
Bye. Listeners, thanks for supporting 16 to 1.
We're trying to grow our audience, so please check us out at 16to1.com, all spelled out, and tell your friends about the show.
On our website, you can find links to follow us on social media, an archive of all our old episodes, and a contact form where you can get in touch.
Thanks again for listening, and we'll catch you next show. It's me, Ichabod Crane.